Credit Company versus Orlando, Mr. Bolso. Bolso.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Colonel Bolso, here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Orlando Residence Limited. There is one question before the court on appeal, a jurisdictional question, which we believe is dispositive of this entire case. And for that reason, I wish this morning to go ahead and focus my time on that question. And the question simply is this: is a lawsuit pending in state court in Nashville, Tennessee, property within the Eastern District of Wisconsin, as the term property is used in the federal in rem jurisdiction statute, 28 U.S.C. section 1655. We submit that the answer to that question clearly is no, that a lawsuit pending in Nashville in state court is not property within the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and that the district court for that reason should have granted our initial motion to dismiss and should have dismissed this action for lack of jurisdiction.
Mr. Bolso, even if this case were to have been filed in the district court in Tennessee, what kind of dominion and control over the metric action would that district court have had?
In this particular case, Your Honor, perhaps none, because the action was already pending in the Chancery Court for Davidson County in a state court. And as the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in the Klein decision, which is cited in our reply brief, where a state court has already assumed jurisdiction of intangible property in that case, it would be improper, and in fact federal courts are precluded from asserting in rem jurisdiction over the same property, so that there could be perhaps some conflict between the state and the federal system between the disposition of property.
The Chancery Court in Tennessee never resolved the issue as to whether GTC had a valid security interest in the metric shows. Isn't that correct?
That is not correct, Your Honor. Actually, Chancellor Lyle, the state court judge, did reach that issue and did issue an opinion.
That's a real loser. I think you were right to focus on your jurisdictional issue.
Well, Judge Posner, the fact is that
there's no final judgment there. It was reversed. I never heard of anyone relying on a reverse judgment to have preclusive effect.
Well, that judgment has not been reversed, Your Honor. The ruling from Chancellor Lyle with regard to this issue.
But the whole judgment, the judgment has been remanded for further action. I mean, it's been reversed and remanded for further action on the statute of limitations question. And, a judgment that's been reversed doesn't have any preclusive effect. Does it?
Well, a judgment that has been reversed, I would agree, Your Honor, has no preclusive effect. But let's be careful about exactly what judgments and what rulings we're talking about.
No. Look, a reversal doesn't necessarily knock out every ruling. But the reversal means that there's no final judgment. Case is back, case has been sent back, it's still a pending case. And you can't use just a ruling which hasn't become final because it's not part of because there's no final judgment to preclude, litigating the issue. Anyway, why don't you get back to your jurisdictional question. Now, if someone wished to had a claim against GP, say, and wished to, assert priority over other possible claimants, where would it file its notice of lien? Wouldn't it have to file it in Wisconsin? Wouldn't the UCC require that?
If a creditor or GP were interested in asserting a lien against personal property as owned by GP, correct,
right,
Your Honor?
Right.
Under the revised UCC, the place to file that would be in GP Credit's place of organization.
Which is Wisconsin.
In this case, it's Oklahoma. It's domiciled in Wisconsin. It's the state of organization remains Oklahoma. But in this particular case, Your Honor, this court, this very court recognized this fact in the guarantee trust case. When you're dealing with situs of personal property, you know, a piece of personal property, especially intangible personal property, may have a situs in one place for a state law question, dealing with a probate or a
lien. That's why I want to settle first, yeah. that for purposes of, if you want to file in some UCC registry in order to get priority over other lienors, you would file in the place of residence of the owner, of the debtor, wouldn't you?
Prior to July 1 of 2001, that is correct, Your Honor.
And what happens after 2000? Is that the place of organization?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let's stick before 2001. So that's where you'd file. You'd file in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Right. You wouldn't file in Tennessee. Well, does it make sense to have the federal statute follow the filing rule and say that if for other, you know, credit purposes, Wisconsin is the place where this lawsuit, this claim is deemed to be, well, that's where you can file your quiet title action?
It does not make sense, Your Honor, because the UCC is concerned with constructive presence of property in order to have an orderly system of the filing of liens and the searching of liens. In the in rem statute in section 1655, Congress, and hence the court, is concerned with the power that a court has in order to be able to take charge, to take possession, to take control of.
Suppose you have a bunch of lienors filing in Wisconsin, the UCC, because they want to get a GP's property, and it includes the lawsuit. They know about the lawsuit, so they file there, and they list all the personal property of GP, including the lawsuit. Now, you're saying that if GP wants to remove the clouds created by these liens, it can't bring its quiet title action in Wisconsin. It has to go to Tennessee. Isn't that kind of confusing?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, in the sense that one has to be careful as to exactly what personal property that we're talking about, because it benefits no one for a federal court in Nashville, in Milwaukee, or anywhere else to render an in rem ruling over property that is not within its district, because it cannot then enforce its ruling. And so you have the predicament that
it can't enforce its ruling. If the federal court in Wisconsin issues an injunction saying that GP owns this lawsuit free and clear of Orlando's claims, that would be enforceable all over the world.
I don't know if that's true, Your Honor. Because
well, it certainly is. I mean, obviously, a federal court can enjoin any legal actions that would undermine its judgment.
Certainly a court that has in personam jurisdiction of the defendants could issue such a binding injunction that would apply all over the world.
No. The whole purpose of quieting title, the whole purpose of in rem jurisdiction is that you issue an injunction that is valid and enforceable regardless of your inability to obtain jurisdiction over, you know, people who claim interest in this. I mean, it's purpose.
Well, that is a purpose, but one thing that is necessary in order for that purpose to be served, and this court recognized this in the Cohagen case decided in 1950, is that the court has to be able to possess, to take over the actual right that is in dispute. Because in that particular case, for example, you had the plaintiff's right to receive patent royalties.
Yeah, but now you're going too far, because now you're suggesting that the federal statute can never be used against intangibles. Because the intangible, you know, bank account, a bond, what have you, it might be in some other state.
And I don't mean to suggest that, Your Honor.
Well, then what's the difference? What's the difference between a person who owns a share of stock in a Bermuda corporation and a person who owns a lawsuit in Tennessee. In both cases, the actual thing of value, stock ownership of Bermuda Corporation, is not in the in the place where the suit is brought.
Well, in the case of a stock or bond or other security, I mean, you do have obviously some tangible manifestation, some evidence of the ownership.
Well, that's the problem with manifestation. That is, there are documents in the possession of GP in Wisconsin which show that it has a lawsuit pending in Tennessee, and somewhere that's like a stock certificate. It's the documentary evidence, but the actual value is somewhere else.
Well, Your Honor, in some of the cases that have been decided under Section 1655 where stock itself has been at issue, the courts have ruled that, and I believe that this was in fact the case in the Guarantee Trust case, which this court decided prior to Cohagan, that even though you had an Illinois corporation which had a domicile here in the state of Illinois, because the stock which had been pledged as collateral in that case was physically present in New York, the plaintiff could not pursue an in-rem case in Chicago. The plaintiff would have had to have gone to New York. Now, in that particular case, it made sense because you had to, obviously, although you're dealing with intangible property rights, you had a situs of the actual thing, the stock certificate, that was at issue. Here, we're dealing with something that is even less tangible than that, a chosen action, which is simply a right to sue someone. In this particular case, it's a breach of contract claim.
Well, what's the right to sue someone and a right to get a dividend from someone who isn't in your district?
Well, let's take that as an example. If that issue were to be decided today, let's say that GP Credit owns a stock in a New York corporation, and the stock certificate is held as pledged collateral by a lender in New York. And GP Credit has its domicile here in Wisconsin. And
but I'm thinking of a much simpler case. Suppose I have stock with a stock certificate in my paw in this New York corporation, and I'm expecting a dividend. I have a right to a dividend. They declare a dividend. I have a right to a dividend. Now that right, you would agree that right, the domicile of that right is Wisconsin, right?
It depends on the purpose, but if one were to perfect a security interest in that right...
What do you mean purpose? I'm saying, suppose someone says, I want to attach GP's personal property, and one of the things GP has is a stock certificate which entitles it to a dividend. Now, isn't that personal property that has a Wisconsin site?
The stock certificate itself is in Wisconsin.
Right.
It's not been pledged anywhere.
No.
In that case, if you were a creditor and you wanted and your goal was to attach the stock, you would certainly attempt to do that in Wisconsin.
Right. And now suppose that I have this stock and I'm expecting my dividend. I have a right to a dividend. They don't pay the dividend. Now I sue. So the right to the dividend has been translated into a chosen action. Well, what difference does it make?
Well,
you have to trot off to New York now to bring your quiet title suit or file your lien or something like that, merely because an intangible right of one sort has been turned into a legal claim.
In that case, Your Honor, you could still pursue the case in Wisconsin because you could easily obtain in personam jurisdiction over GP Credit, which is a citizen and resident of Wisconsin.
But look, the federal statute is symmetrical. You bring a suit either to establish a lien or to clear it out. To enforce any lien upon or claim to or to remove any encumbrance or lien or cloud, etc. So if Wisconsin is the place to sue in order to attach the lien, it's the place to sue in order to remove it.
Well, I understand your argument, Your Honor, but in this particular case, we're not dealing with a factual vacuum and a hypothetical vacuum. We have got a record that establishes that Nashville Lodging Company, the owner of this chosen action, actually filed it in Nashville in state court.
Yeah, but that was an acquired title action.
It's the actual lawsuit itself, Your Honor. That's right.
Right, but that's just like saying, you know, you might have to go to New York in order to sue for your dividend. Nevertheless, that right is a right that has its site in Wisconsin because that's where the owner of it is.
Well, and once again, I do not believe that a stock and chosen action are necessarily going to be treated the same under Section 1655 because...
Well, it's going to be very confusing, I think.
Well, we've had this court's held that the patent rights are not subject to 1655. Other courts have held that franchise rights are not subject to Section 1655. Further courts have held that a chosen action itself is not subject to Section 1655. The Wabash case, which was cited by this court in Cahagan, said specifically that a chosen action was not property within Section 1655. Your Honor, I think the fundamental point here that I'm trying to make, and my time is now out, so let me say it for the one time.
Of course.
Is that this chosen action is not like any chosen action that may exist hypothetically. There's actually been a filing of a lawsuit that the chose is actually pending in Nashville in state court. The Chancery Court has appointed a receiver. The purpose of which is to have the receiver collect any proceeds of that case by way of settlement or judgment and pay them into the registry of the court for further disposition by the court. Under those circumstances, where NLC has itself voluntarily chosen to pursue its chosen action in Nashville, the proper place for any type of resolution of the ownership of that claim we submit should be in Nashville. And under Section 1655, this court in Milwaukee only had jurisdiction if that lawsuit could be considered property within the Eastern District of Wisconsin. We submit that it cannot be. Thank you.
Okay,
I have a question if you don't mind. I am sitting here and wondering why Orlando didn't take any steps to object to the public sale of NLC's personal property.
Well, we have done that, Your Honor. It's not a matter of record. But the fact is that there have been a number of fraudulent conveyances that have been entered into by the defendant, in this case the principal, a gentleman named Ken Nelson. And this was purportedly a sale between his company and his wife's company.
Right.
It was held the week before our motion to subject was going to be heard in Nashville.
Right.
And I was provided an email, I believe by Mr. Nelson or by his counsel, on Thursday afternoon of a Friday sale. And we didn't, frankly, think that there's anything that could be done between Mr. Nelson and Mrs. Nelson and his counsel's wife that was going to have any type of a substantive effect on our legal rights. And so what we have done, frankly, is to file a fraudulent conveyance action, which is pending down in Tennessee, alleging that this transfer, this alleged sale, that occurred on or about May the 10th of 2001 was simply done to defraud our ability to recover our judgment, and that case is now pending in Tennessee.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Ahrens?
May it please the Court, my name is Gary Ahrens, and I represent the appellee, GP Credit Company. I would like to first address my remarks to Mr. Bolso's out-of-the-record assertions about fraudulent conveyances. As this Court is aware, there is one fraudulent conveyance that has been adjudicated. That determination was reversed by the Tennessee Court of Appeal. It remanded for the only remaining issue as to the statute of limitations. The record is clear in this case. There has never been a dispute that GP Credit advanced approximately $1 million to NLC so that NLC could pursue the metric claim and other claims in Tennessee. That was never an issue. It was never disputed. in this action.
Just as a matter of factual background, can you tell us what is the status of the litigation in the Metra case and of the remand in the so-called 92 litigation between Orlando and NLC in the Tennessee court?
I cannot tell you what the status in the Metra case is. I can tell you, although Mr. Bolso would be more conversant to this, that as far as I'm aware, the remand in the by the Tennessee Court of Appeals for trial on the statute of limitations issue, that trial has not taken place or been scheduled. I would like to address some remarks to the jurisdictional issue. I think that Mr. Bolso draws a distinction that doesn't stand up as a matter of philosophy or logic. The Sheraton action that GP Credit sought to clear title on was the right to the proceeds of the lawsuit, or the right to control that lawsuit.
Does GP concede, as Orlando claims, that its security interest was not perfected?
We concede that the security interest was not perfected by a proper filing with the Secretary of State. We believe that Orlando doesn't have any standing on that point because it did not have a lien at that. The trial court held that Orlando didn't have a lien. NLC pledged the rights to these suits to GP Credit, to secure GP Credit's loans. NLC is a Wisconsin limited partnership with its citizenship and residence in Wisconsin. So we have a pledge of an intangible asset of a Wisconsin limited partnership to another entity, a limited partnership in this case, located a citizen and domiciled in Wisconsin. In that circumstance, it would make sense that the only place that has a real interest in the situs of that intangible property is the state of Wisconsin. Now, the trial court did not make a finding that there was no situs in Tennessee. It simply found that there was, in fact, a situs in Wisconsin. And as Mr. Bolso has argued over and over again, it is possible there could be more than one situs. Although I think that it is important to note that many of the cases that Mr. Bolso has called to the court's attention are pre-1938 cases. In other words, they are before Erie. And as the trial court noted, after Erie, it's obliged to apply the substantive law of Wisconsin. So if the court's sitting in Wisconsin, it's faced with a Wisconsin litigant who is a domiciliary and a citizen of Wisconsin saying, this is my property, so the court, I believe, properly looked to Wisconsin law.
What about that? It's an interesting point about patent rights. Patent rights are not considered intangible personal property.
Well, I think there's a confusion here between what the holding of the Cohagen suit was and some of the other remarks in the case. Cohagen, and I am answering the court's question, Cohagen is directed, dismissed, or ruled on the grounds that the applicant seeking to avail himself of 1655 was not seeking to clear some kind of title to a pre-existing right, but was trying to establish a claim for a money judgment in the first instance. And I think that's the distinction here, that patent rights are, if we're going to sue for an intangible, I would imagine that if I had a patent, if there was an issue that I owned a patent, and I knew there were other claimants out there that thought they owned the patent, now that would be a question of state law. I could then bring this action under 1655 to clear my title to my patent ownership. Well, I could not bring an action under 1655 to sue someone for infringement. So that would be my answer. Mm-hmm. I believe that the case itself has had a life breathed into it by ORL much longer than it deserved. When this case was remanded by the Tennessee Court of Appeals, reversed, it ceased to be a final judgment. ORL ceased to be a judgment creditor. ORL's arguments that somehow liens have survived, liens and judgments survived the ending of its status as a judgment creditor, I believe have no basis in law. I think it's very clear in the Tennessee law that we have cited to the court that where there is something left for a court to do, there is no final judgment.
I'm still having trouble sorting out. There was an original case in which $1,351,934,000 was awarded by the jury. That case was reversed by the Tennessee Court of Appeals.
There have been two appeals in Tennessee.
Right.
There was an original case in which there was a jury verdict and there were punitive damages and summary judgment. That case was reversed. Then there was another trial.
And they had a $797,000 plus verdict in that one.
And that case was reversed on the grounds that the court had not decided the statute of limitations defense. That statute of limitation remains defense remains to be tried. And it, as far as I know, it's not been set.
That subjects the entire proceeding to be in question. In other words, if the statute of limitations run, there's no chance of recovery.
Well, a statute of limitations would be a complete defense.
Right.
If successful, a complete defense.
And that's what they sent it back for.
And I would believe so. As I think it's clear here that proving 99% of your case is not enough. You must prove all of your case, and then the defendant must fail in his proof of his affirmative defenses. And only then is the final judgment awarded. And the peculiar situation of this case is there is no final judgment. There's a Tennessee rule of appellate procedure that says no final judgment, a judgment that's not final is not enforceable. And yet we have a party here contending that somehow a lien, which is a device used to enforce a creditor's rights, somehow exists, that a judgment somehow exists. What ORL has right now is the benefit of the law of the case in Tennessee. It does not have a final judgment. By analogy, if
you're saying that their interest is that of a judgment creditor, and that they don't have the judgment, is that your argument?
No, my argument is that they are not a judgment creditor.
I understand, but is judgment creditor the pigeonhole they have to be in, or is there some alternative pigeonhole?
Well, there would be a judicially created lien or some kind of consensual or statutorily created lien. There's no, for example, no warehouseman's lien, no attorney's lien, nothing like that. There's no consensual lien. So the only left is a judicially created lien, and we've had this, the courts received an education in Tennessee procedure on collection matters. We believe that there was no proper collection lien while the judgment was alive, and there's no more lien now that the judgment is dead. Because just as if you paid off your mortgage and the mortgage was still recorded, it may still be recorded, but it's not a lien.
But you did say ORL has something, which is the law of the case.
It has the benefit of the law of the case. But, for example, if for whatever reason the case was never again set for trial, ORL could not go out and levy executions. If, for example,
So the significance of the law of the case is that if they can defeat the summary, if they can defeat the statute of limitations defense, the judgment will probably be reinstated. Right?
Yes.
That's the law of the case. The court isn't going to re-examine the merits once the statute of limitations issue is resolved in favor of OR or Metric, rather.
Well, Metric's not in that suit. But if the
fact... I've lost the sense. What happened
to... NLC does a lawsuit against Metric.
Right.
That case has been adjudicated. Metric's adjudicated liable. The Tennessee judge has required Metric to put $5 million aside. Okay? Now the question is, and as far as I know, it's what happens with the damages, and there's some rulings and appeals and this and that, but I'm not part of that suit. ORL has a suit against NLC. ORL, in our position, has still not rung the bell. They must defeat that last defense.
I understand. If Orlando had a judgment against NLC, then that would be a lien which it could assert maybe against GP.
Well, if the lien had been valid, then arguably, I mean, if you buy an automobile that has a security interest on it or some other kind of lien on it, and you don't clear that lien out, you take subject to the lien. And in the briefing, we've shown how, one, ORL didn't properly acquire its lien under the Tennessee statutes. It misdates. For example, ORL says that, the writ of execution didn't come back unsatisfied. Well, the only logical conclusion is if it didn't come back unsatisfied, it came back satisfied, and what are we doing here? If it's satisfied, the case is over. It came back unsatisfied. They didn't file for a lien in a timely way. They lost those liens. At the time of the public sale, May 11th, at that time, there was nothing going on that affected NLC's right to its lawsuit. And that was when the public sale occurred. Now,
did the public sale occur on the 5th of May?
Your Honor, I believe it's a typo by the district court that we failed to get corrected. As far as I can tell, it is the 11th. It has always been the 11th. I don't think that there's a dispute between Mr. Bolso and I on that. I think it's just a typographical. So, at the time of the public sale, GP Credit buys. There were other bidders, or there was another person present, but no one bid. If ORL wanted to, it could have objected to the sale, it could have brought some kind of a proceeding in Wisconsin to stop the sale, it didn't. And after that, ORL then went back into court in Tennessee and asked for a motion for a receiver. And the judge, I think the chancellor in Tennessee, did exactly what the judge should do, is to do exactly what was needed and no more. The judge simply said this money isn't going anywhere until we figure out who it belongs to. She did not grant any motion to subject any asset to execution, just as previously, before the sale, she had denied the motion to subject the assets to execution.
Didn't she appoint a receiver to collect and pay into court the proceeds, as the metric shows?
But she did that knowing that there had not yet been a final trial on the metric case. And what she was concerned about, because Mr. Bolson never misses a chance to malign Mr. Nelson, was that somehow Mr. Nelson would spirit these funds out of Tennessee. So she said, no, they're not going anywhere. They're just going to stay right there, and somebody can tell me, or someone I can get a motion as to who they belong to. Now, that is one of the reasons that this case exists. In her order, she specifically made reference to the federal case in Wisconsin as something which she would then expect to be informed about, or that might affect the disposition of her order appointing the receiver. Again, she was very careful to do what she perceived to be necessary to freeze the status quo without going into any kind of adjudication of merits or arguments that weren't properly before her. And as the court's indicated before, I think she did exactly what the task was and was very careful in her circumspection as to the extent of her order.
Okay, so then we go to May of 2002, right? When the Tennessee Court of Appeals affirms the finding of fraud and damages, but reverses and remands on the statute of limitations, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And then we go to January 27th of 2003, where the Supreme Court of Tennessee denies the review.
It was ORL that asked for review. I think both parties asked for review and were both denied. So now the case, I believe the I believe that the Court of Appeals decision is final in the sense that there are no further reviews that can be taken, or petitions for review that can be made to it.
Isn't the law of the case that there was a perpetration of a fraud between NCL or NLC and Nelson?
Well,
I mean, if the only thing left is statute of limitations, they're not going to revisit the fraud issue, are they?
Well, I agree. They're not going to, and this is a fraudulent conveyance.
Right.
And there's a difference between a fraudulent conveyance and a fraud. Right. I know that in the initial briefing, ORL talks of guilty. I don't think that anyone has been adjudged guilt here, of guilt. But the point is that while there has been
a conveyance without compensation, is that the nature of the conveyance?
Well, it was hotly disputed, Your Honor. I was not in that case.
Well, doesn't that defeat in rem jurisdiction in Wisconsin, then, if there's a fraudulent conveyance?
Well, the fraudulent conveyance had absolutely nothing to do with the metric lawsuit. It's simply it was related to another piece of property and a note and other debts between ORL and NLC. It doesn't
just be the premise for a lien by a lien acquired by ORL against GP, but you say there's no lien because there's no judgment yet or any other.
It never would have been a premise for a lien against GP. It might have been, had the statutory formalities been followed, a premise for a lien against NLC. Because remember,
right, but GP has succeeded to NLC, right?
Well, I mean, it purchased at a public sale,
yeah.
And it purchased for value, and there is no doubt, never any issue, that what GP got, which is the right to proceed to proceeds of a lawsuit in Tennessee, which may or may not come, it got in foreclosing its loan of almost $1 million to NLC. And that
now,
was no money.
Now, you said so the metric case is over, and the question is, were there any assets?
No, I don't believe the metric case is over. I believe the metric case is pending.
You mentioned of $5 million. Or
liability was determined.
Okay, liability was assessed against metric for $5 million?
No, liability for breach of contract. It was breach of a settlement agreement arranged in open court in California. Liability was adjudicated. I know, the case is has certain elements of the esoteric. The liability was adjudicated on summary judgment many years ago, and it has been difficult getting the damages case to trial. There have been innumerable pretrial motions about the scope of damages available and what damages were permitted. I know I believe that some of those are on appeal, but I'm not precisely privy on those.
But if somehow Metric is eventually ordered to pay NLC $5 million, that's the show's in action, right, to that $5
million? At this time, yes.
That would be true.
That's, we contend that would be paid. And GP owns that.
Right, and that's what GP owns, right? That's your show's in action. But now, how much of that does ORL want? That is that the
figure?
That's
$797 plus.
Would that be the value of its lien if it overcomes the statute of limitations defense?
I think that there may be some issues of interest, and they're going to, I don't know if they'll try. I mean, I think that they would contend that they have a money damages judgment in that amount. They would contend there would be post-verdict interest on that. I'm not precisely conversant with Tennessee law on that. But what if they could overcome that statute of limitations defense, then they would take that position.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Ahrens. And Mr. Bolzo, your time expired, but we'll give you a couple of minutes since this is such a complicated case.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to just make one factual correction and then address three points that were raised. It was Nashville Lodging Company, Your Honor, that actually sought permission to appeal from the Tennessee Supreme Court. Orlando Residence Limited did not seek permission. We did not oppose Nashville Lodging Company's request, but we didn't seek it independently ourselves. The Supreme Court ultimately denied it. The three points are these. There was a point made regarding Erie. Your Honor, Judge Posner had made a point regarding a pigeonhole, and then Mr. Ahrens made a comment about missed dates. First, with regard to Erie, more than what this panel decides with regard to how Section 1655 is to be interpreted, that is, how you interpret the phrase property in the district, I think we should all agree that it is a question of federal law, not state law, which is why the district court's analysis, which was the plaintiff's analysis, we believe was seriously flawed. Because what happened here was that the district court said, well, this case is before me on diversity, and I therefore apply the substantive law of the state of Wisconsin in resolving this case.
But and I don't understand that, because this 1655 is just a procedural statute. It doesn't create lands or remove lands. What constitutes a land? Who owns it, and so on? That's all a matter of state law.
Your Honor, every case that I'm aware of that has decided this case has decided it under federal law. In the Cohagen case, the Gilmore case, the Guarantee Trust case, the Chase versus Wetzler case, all the federal cases from the 7th, the 9th, the 7th, and the U.S. Supreme Court have
followed. You mean the question where the property is located?
Exactly. For example, the 7th Circuit in Cohagen did not look at Illinois law and say, what does Illinois say about where property is located? The Guarantee Trust case did not ask that question. The Gilmore Court, the 9th Circuit, did not say, what is California law with regard to what the situs is of personal property? All those courts looked at it from the standpoint of what is the federal law? What is the meaning of this statute? And certainly we submit that it makes sense that in interpreting a federal statute or the U.S. Constitution or a federal regulation, that those are all questions of federal law, and that those issues do not turn on state law in this case.
Well, that's not obvious. I mean, would you say that it's federal law that determines what is real or personal property? Well, what is a land?
No, not that, Your Honor. There's a phrase in 1655 that says property in the district. And the question in this case and in many others is, what is property in the district? Our point, Your Honor, is that is a federal question, that the court looks to federal law to determine what Congress intended by that language. It does not look to state law under Erie to determine whether or not personal property, whether tangible or intangible, has a situs in a given area.
Well, it's state law to decide what is a land and what is real property and what is personal property. Why can't it look to state law to decide where it's located so that we can have uniformity with the Uniform Commercial Code?
Because the question, the purposes of the UCC and the purposes of in-rem jurisdiction are different.
I don't understand that, because the purpose of the UCC, so far as bears on a case like this, is to provide notice and, you know, orderly, to provide notice of security interests. And this is a statute about how you create or remove security interest. So you think that you'd want them to work together?
It is, Your Honor, but the ultimate issue with regard to all these cases is, does the court have the power? Does it have the control over the asset? And federal courts, at least to the extent that I've read them, have looked to federal law to determine whether or not the court has adequate control or possession or can take possession of an asset. It doesn't look to a state law that might deal with a constructive
possession. You have to have diversity jurisdiction to bring 1655 in, don't you?
Or a federal question, sure.
But I mean, there's no federal question here. So this is entirely, I mean, the dispute between the parties is entirely a matter of state law. The lawsuit in Tennessee and all this
stuff,
that's all state law.
That's all state law.
Why don't you make your other two points?
Sure. The second one with regard to pigeonholes, Your Honor, the reason that we submit that the lien that that was previously in existence as a judgment lien has not gone away is simply that although we no longer have a judgment lien, that is, ORL no longer has a judgment lien because its judgment has been reversed, those liens have never been removed. And what would occur if the plaintiff, or excuse me, in this case, if National Lodging Company, the plaintiff here, the defendant in Tennessee, were to go in to try to have those liens removed, is that they would be immediately converted by Chancellor Lyle into prejudgment liens. She would, in all likelihood, issue a non-proton order saying that this lien does not lose priority from the time that it came into effect. And so we'd have exactly the same situation then that we had before the judgment was reversed. It's true, it would no longer be a judgment lien, but there is a different pigeonhole. It would become a prejudgment lien in one of the specific, and Title 29 of the Tennessee Code governs prejudgment liens, and there's a specific statute, a specific provision that says if there is a concern that the proceeds of a lawsuit may be fraudulently taken away from the court's jurisdiction, that is grounds for having a prejudgment attachment.
Sure, but that's an interim sort of thing. What's your third point?
The third point is regarding missed dates. The plaintiff did not miss any dates. Orlando Residence Limited did not miss any dates with regard to the filing of an execution lien. The claim is made here that somehow the execution was returned unsatisfied. It was not. The execution is in the record. It appears in the record, I believe, at pages 34 and 35 of the appendix. It does not say anywhere on its face that it was returned unsatisfied. And the reason for that is simple, that it was executed. The sheriff went, served properly the execution on, in that particular case, counsel for Nashville Lodging Company, and returned it to the court. The reason that the execution never went forward is because Chancellor Lyle ultimately determined that you cannot execute on a chosen action owned by a limited partnership. Under Tennessee law, you can only do that with regard to a corporation. So we then had to file a separate motion to subject under Section 26-4-102, which does not require an unsatisfied execution in order to bring that motion. Mm-hmm. JP Credit has been arguing all along that we needed an unsatisfied execution to file a motion to subject. That may be true under 26-4-101. It is not true under 26-4-102, which was the precise relief that we requested in our motion to subject, which is also in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.